Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much money do you need to get by? How much do you need to be happy? And how is anybody in 21st century America supposed to know the difference? My guest today is pretty open about his earnings, which in recent years have been in the mid-$30,000 range. Combined with his wife's income, the money provides their family with a pretty comfortable middle-class existence. But Ben Hewitt remains troubled by the American definition of wealth, which is linked exclusively to money, and which he has come to believe risks eroding the true richness of human existence and the natural world. The new book by author Ben Hewitt is called Saved: How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. Ben, welcome back to Think.
Hey, great to be here, Chris. Thanks.
So, like a lot of Americans, you were sort of taken aback by the vanishing money phenomenon of the financial crisis in 2008, and it made you realize that you hadn't ever really thought a lot about what money represented in our culture.
Yeah, well, first I want to thank you for that term, vanishing money phenomenon. I love it, and I may actually borrow that in the future. I hadn't heard it before. But yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, at that point, I was making sort of what I would deem a comfortably lower middle class income. And I just wanted to clarify one thing. My wife is actually a stay-at-home mother and tends to our small farm. So I'm pretty much the sole provider of my family.
Oh, thanks for the correction. Okay.
Sure. But anyway, at that point, you know, in 2008, I had this sort of really nice freelance writing gig that had been going on for, you know, a dozen or so years, and felt, you know, very comfortable and relatively secure. And, you know, I think like a lot of Americans, that was a real inflection point for, you know, a real sense of vulnerability that I had never before experienced. And within the span of about 6 or 7 months, a number of titles that I had been writing for just closed their doors. I lost a $20,000 a year annual contributing editor retainer that I'd had for the 6 or 7 years prior, and that was about half of our income. Mm. And so, you know, for a lot of reasons, we were able to weather that, you know, perhaps better than some people would, and maybe we'll talk about some of those reasons later on. But it was this, you know, this point of just awakening to the fact that I was so incredibly dependent on forces beyond my control, mostly having to do with money, that I really wanted to sort of better understand that.
Yeah, and of course there are alternative ways to think about wealth, but most of us get really stuck on the simplest version, which is that money and wealth are the same thing.
Yeah, and you know, I am just so fascinated now, having spent the last couple of years, you know, thinking about this a lot, the ways in which money and finance have hijacked so much of our language around wealth. So, you know, when we talk about, I mean, the root of the word economics or economy has nothing to do with money. And yet when we talk about the economy, I think most of all of us have this image in our head of things that are relating to money and finance, you know, wealth, just as you point out. So prosperity, I mean, we have all of this language that, you know, I'm not suggesting that money perhaps shouldn't be a part of it, but it has become almost entirely hijacked by what I sort of call the mentality of money, I guess.
What is the difference between the conscious economy and the unconscious economy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love to talk about this because, as you know, these are two terms that I introduce in the book. And the unconscious economy is, in a sense, almost what we were just talking about. It's this idea that, you know, everything is about money. And it's also the ways in which money works to sort of separate us from sort of good intent in terms of how we're sort of living our lives and the relationships that we have. So that's sort of the unconscious part of it. You know, and conscious economy is the idea that we start to have this awareness, not only of like how money works, but what the implications of that are. And I think, you know, it's something that we're not really encouraged to think about, because there's very little sort of profit in us being discerning regarding how we use our money. You know, pretty much the vast majority of our economy, and now when I say economy, I'm talking again about the sort of moneyed economy, you know, the vast majority of that depends on us not thinking very hard about how much power money has and what our intent is for our money.
So Tell us about your friend, Eric, how you got to know him and how you started to realize how differently he approached these notions of wealth and of money.
I got to know him, you know, so during this period, you know, coincidentally or maybe not coincidentally, who knows, but during this period of sort of financial turmoil in our country. And it came about because he works with children doing wilderness skills, and our children were in a group that he was working with, so he would take them into the woods and you know, teach them all sorts of really cool things out in nature. And, you know, I was sort of first drawn to him the way that a lot of people are drawn to him, which is that he is just one of the most sort of contented, grounded people I've ever met. So I knew nothing about his financial background or his relationship to money. I only knew that, you know, he's one of those people, and, you know, you may have people like this in your life that, you know, you just meet them and you just have a sense of them being incredibly comfortable in their own skin, and you have a sense of them, you know, living their lives in a way that is really meaningful to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that sense about Eric. And so there was that aspect of him that I was really drawn to. And, you know, the better I got to know him, the more I became aware of the actual sort of financial particulars of his life, which at the time, and pretty much still do actually, include living on $6,000 to $7,000 a year. And so part of me was just sort of, you know, fascinated, you know, by the idea of, like, you know, we all think about, you know, money can't buy happiness. I mean, it's a cliche, really. And it seemed to me that Eric presented this opportunity to really try to understand that correlation between money and happiness or contentment. You know, was it the fact that he didn't have much money that enabled him to be so content, or was it the fact that he was so content that enabled him to thrive without very much money? I mean, that was one of the questions I sort of sought to answer.
He did tell you that he looks at people in their big fancy houses, you know, with their cars and their boats and whatever else, cell phones, and wonders if they're not far more trapped and less free than he is.
Yeah, and, you know, we get to another aspect, Eric, that is really compelling, and it is that of anyone I know, he has perhaps more autonomy over his time than is commonplace, and certainly than I've experienced in any of my other relationships. And so, you know, I was just really struck by the fact that he had sort of created this incredible richness of time. And, you know, here's the thing. I mean, I don't necessarily think that to experience that, you have to sort of give up money. I mean, this isn't really about a rejection of money, you know. It's much more about an embrace of so many different other facets of the human experience and of wealth.
Hmm.
And I just, you know, the more time I spent with Eric, the more I realized that he was embracing these things in a way that has become, or I think is becoming, less and less common in our society. And maybe in some cases in a way that, you know, a lot of people just simply don't have the luxury of doing, because they're so wrapped up in, you know, working to make a living just to pay for the basic necessities of life.
And you discovered, although he does devote some time to earning, you know, cash to live on and to spend, when you would hang out with him, he sort of wouldn't know what time it was,
right,
wouldn't care. So something you thought was going to take half an hour took 2.5. He
right.
barely seemed to notice that.
You know, yeah, and I think part of it was that there was a sense of him sort of inhabiting his time in a way. And I don't know if this happens to you, but I know it happens to me, you know, where I'm constantly sort of rushing to get to the next thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I feel this incredible sort of pressure to move onward. It's happening less and less to me, in large part because of, you know, the process of writing this book, which in truly has been incredibly transformative for me. But still, you know, it still is this sense of, like, you know, not really inhabiting the moment that I'm in right now. And I don't see that with Eric really almost ever. So he has this, even though he's very punctual, interestingly enough, but he just doesn't seem to be sort of beholden to time in the same way that a lot of other people are. And I think a lot of that is because he's just incredibly content. So he's generally doing things that he feels really passionate and good about. And so he doesn't feel, you know, pressure to sort of move on to something else. And, you know, just on a more pragmatic level, you know, he doesn't have, I mean, he does have a job, but he works fairly part-time, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't have a lot of the same sort of responsibilities, many of which are sort of linked to economic expectations that we have. He doesn't have those sort of same responsibilities to sort of move on to.
It's worth noting that at least during the time period that you cover the book, he doesn't have kids to support or take care of.
Yeah.
And that did occur to me as I was reading about his life, which sounded wonderful in some ways, and I thought, oh, that would not work with a house full of kids.
Well, in some ways, I think you're right. And in some ways, I'm not certain. And I guess, you know, this is something my wife and I talk about all the time. You know, how would Eric, you know, when we have situations that arise with our kids that sort of require us to sort of participate a little bit more in the sort of moneyed economy than we might like to, you know, how would Eric handle this? We're always asking ourselves. And of course, he doesn't have kids, so we can't know for certain. I will say, you know, that I think a lot of our expectations around what we do for our children are, you know, and in regards particularly to expectations that need to be met through money and finance, are societal expectations. They're very rarely true needs of our children. And so as an example, you know, I was doing an interview last week, and someone said, well, what do you do when your kids need new shoes? And, you know, I had to sort of chuckle because I literally cannot remember the last time my kids got a new piece of clothing. And, you know, some people might say, oh, those poor kids. But my kids don't feel that way because they don't have that expectation.
You also, you know, we've talked a little bit about time here, and you really bristle against the old adage that time is money. How have we taken that and sort of corrupted it to the sense that it doesn't really work for us anymore?
Wow, yeah. I mean, this is, in some ways, I feel like this is like the central thesis of the book. You know, it's a very difficult book to sum up in a single sentence, which maybe it's downfall, I don't know. But, you know, I suppose if I were going to sum it up in a single sentence, it's like, you know, have that awareness that the way you spend your time is the way you spend your life.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, what I see is that the belief that time is money is one that is certainly encouraged by an economy that really depends upon us, you know, sort of seeking out goods and services that we feel like we can't afford to produce for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the notion is so flawed, and I guess for anyone who really sort of wants to push back at that a little bit, I would really encourage them to seek out someone who is terminally ill and ask them what they think of the idea that time is money.
Hmm. Yeah, it is interesting to think about so many of the things. I mean, the book really just sort of forces you to think about what we assume we have to do. And then, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, who's making me do this?
Right. It's a great point. I mean, so much of our expectations and so much of the way we have constructed our lives in contemporary America is based on assumptions that this is the way it should be. It's, you know, now I have to say I have tremendous empathy for people who have been to those assumptions, I guess, to a certain extent. And I certainly have to a certain extent in my own life. You know, this is what we are encouraged to do. This is what we have been socialized to believe is sort of, you know, the good and right way to live our lives. And there, you know, to be clear, there are certain benefits that come of it. But I think that what we really are talking about is, in some cases, in a lot of cases, is a sort of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have exchanged a lot of times, I really feel like, the interdependence upon one another as neighbors and friends and community members for complete and total dependence on institutions that are, you know, too big to fail, that are really far outside our purview. I mean, we have very little influence and control.
My guest is author Ben Hewitt. His new book is called Saved: How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Ben Hewitt, whose new book is called Saved: How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. So, Ben, I think people might be surprised to hear this book characterized as a celebration of materialism, but you have a different way of defining materialism than most people think of.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways what we need is a sort of a sort of reverent materialism, I guess, you know, a sort of new level of materialism in which, you know, materialism isn't just defined by quantity, but is instead sort of defined by quality and by this, you know, our desire to really, you know, have reverence and respect for these goods because they are. They are embodied energy in a sense. They, you know, all of the things that we all use in our lives on a day-to-day basis, you know, are comprised of really very, very precious and in some cases very finite resources. Hmm. And I think it behooves us to be, you know, sort of much more aware of the implications of where these things come from. And to sort of, you know, materialism has sort of got this negative connotation, and I understand why that is. I think it's a lot of it's because it is just about quantity, you know, amassing a large quantity of really sort of poor quality goods. And so I'm just saying perhaps we should shift that focus a little bit.
A nice example of this is that, first of all, it might also surprise people that your friend Eric actually has some savings despite making very little money in a given year. But when he decided he really needed a bicycle,
right,
he went and bought a good one, a used one, but a good one. And you were worried, oh, the thing's going to get trashed. It's bumping over these country roads. It's out in the rain. And then you realized that he bought it not to have, but to use.
That's right. You know, it was like, he, you know, Eric is one of those people who is not really interested in accumulating a bunch of stuff just to have it. And I remember this, you know, that incident you're talking about so well. You know, I ran into him, and it was actually winter. It was like this January day, and you know, that may not be a big deal where you are, but up here, you know, you don't really. Most people aren't out riding their bike in January, and yet here he was, and it was all slushy, and the bike was looking a little bedraggled. And I'm thinking to myself, geez, you know, come on, man. And yet, you know, I realized, you know, that the bike to him, you know, he had bought it to use it for its intended purpose, and part of that intended purpose in this case included taking it out in the snow, and I knew he was going to take it down and take it home and wipe it down and care for it. And the other thing that really sort of stuck with me about that particular purchase, you know, as I relate in the book, is that, you know, Eric really struggled with that. I think the bike was $600 and something, which for him, you know, is just an enormous quantity of money. And he sort of reframed his idea of what it was, what that bike was costing him, and he began to look at it in terms of the time it was going to take him to earn that money. Mm-hmm. And so he thought to himself, wow, is this worth 3 days of my life out, you know, spending time in the wilderness with children? And that was a really sort of affirmational process for him. It just made me wonder, like, you know, how would it change our sort of ethos of consumption if people considered their purchases in the context of the portion of their life that they're going to give up to procure that, whatever that item is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Emily in Plano. Hi, Emily.
Hello, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
I'm going to make a comment. I found this really relevant to me, and first of all, I want to thank you both for just bringing this topic up about quality and quantity of time. One of the main reasons I am with my boyfriend currently is he has brought the quality of time to my life. I am a working college kid. I am going to school pretty much full time this summer and going to get my real estate license and working, trying to make, you know, rent and get food on the table. And I often get lost in all the things that I want to do for me, I think, is furthering my career and making sure that I will have plenty of money, unlike, you know, a lot of my peer group. And I just wanted to touch on how maybe young people are either using too much of their time on what, you know, is almost unnecessary now. Like right now I'm taking a literature class that I am never going to use again in my life. I'm just right. doing it because I have to get my associate's degree. And it's required that I take this literature class. And I'm never really going to be utilizing any of this information. It's like, but I'm forcing myself to just get it done because I want my associate's. Like,
well, what do you think about all that, Ben?
Well, I mean, she's bringing up a point that's really near and dear to my heart, which is our educational expectations. And I think of it more in the context of my children, of course. You know, I think she has a fantastic point, which is that particularly in the context of education, there is a tremendous amount of time wasted. It's one of the reasons, you know, actually, that my next book is about education and about, you know, the way in which we educate our children, which is through some home study. But I fully agree, and you know, I think it's really somewhat tragic that our expectations for education are so intertwined with our expectations, our economic expectations, and I think also. In a lot of cases, and I see this more in parents, I guess, than in children, but parents, I think, have this tremendous sort of, I live with this tremendous fear that their children are not going to be able to sort of compete economically. And so a lot of our choices around education, which really, you know, separate children often from their families and from their communities increasingly. I mean, we have kids going to school for longer and longer and longer. Over the course of the year, you know, they're really all choices that are made out of fear that our kids simply aren't going to be able to make their way in this world.
Well, I think it would surprise a lot of people that you not only don't have a college degree, you dropped out of high school.
That's right, I did. And, you know, in a strange way, I see that as having been, you know, almost a privilege. Because, you know, if I had like gone on through high school and gone on to college, the likelihood is that I would have accrued a lot of debts, mm-hmm. And the likely outcome of that is that I would not have been able to pursue a career in writing and small scale agriculture, which is what I do, and both of which I feel really, really passionately about and feel incredibly fortunate to be able to fill my days with. So in a way, I see it as sort of having been an enabling factor, which I know may seem sort of antithetical to a lot of people. But, you know, again, I feel as if, you know, even the assumption that the only way to get an education is to go to school, I think is really, really flawed. There are, of course, a lot of ways for us to educate ourselves and to educate our children.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Elena in Fort Worth. Hi, Elena.
Hi. I was listening to your guest talk about applying some of his friend's ideals to his children. And when you said something about thinking about the value of something in terms of the work that you put into it, I don't have any kids myself, but I know a lot of my friends' children, and they'll say, "Mom, I want an iPad." Or, "I want new jeans," and they're $50 jeans. And I say, "Okay, if these jeans cost $50 and you make $7.50 an hour, how many hours," and, you know, I kind of turn it into a game or math, "how many hours will you have to work to purchase those jeans?" And when kids think about that, it actually, I think, helps them consider how money will affect their life in the future. Because as a child, you have no idea what money is.
What do you think about that, Ben?
I think it's a great point. I think that what she's doing by encouraging kids to think about it in that way is really valuable. I mean, you know, again, it's like I don't want to sort of beat this point over the head, but we have to acknowledge that the only thing that we really truly own in our lives is our time. And I think, you know, obviously we all need to exchange a certain portion of our time and our lives for, you know, the money that we need. I'm not saying that we should all start living on $6,000 a year or that we all need to totally reject money. I am saying exactly what the point that she's making, which is, and this is that sort of consciousness that I talked about a little bit earlier, you know, it's just really having an awareness of the decisions that you're making around money. And, you know, what's really fascinating is, when you start to think about it, is that money is at the core of so many different aspects and decisions that we have to make in our life. I mean, when I was waiting for the show to come on, I was listening to your local news, and there were three stories, and they all in some way or another were related to money. And as I've been going out and talking about this book, you know, the conversations that have been coming out of these, out of my readings and these discussions are just fascinating in the sort of breadth and variety. I mean, we, you know, people end up wanting to talk about things like death, about like their fear of death, about, you know, how, you know, about the environment, about the connection between money and what we're doing to our environment. Healthcare is a huge one. I mean, our healthcare system is so broken, and you know the primary reason it's so broken is that it's totally entrenched in the sort of mentality of money. And so there are connections between almost every aspect of our lives and our expectations for money and the way money works in our society.
It does seem that of all the areas that we've discussed so far, healthcare is the one where it's sort of hard. You're up against a wall if you need care and don't have money and don't sort of qualify for particular benefits or whatever. You know, when a minor procedure, you know, surgical procedure is $25,000, money starts to feel like a vital thing to have.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, I think healthcare is the thorniest almost of all of these issues to navigate in this regard, and the one where I think people feel the most vulnerability. And it's, I think in some ways really sad because I think, you know, fear of going without healthcare or of being faced with this, exactly the situations you're talking about is often, it's a huge factor often in people not being able to sort of live their passion and to do what it is that they really feel called to do. You know, and so they stick out these jobs that they maybe really dislike. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans, of course, are dissatisfied with their jobs. And so, you know, which means they're spending, you know, the majority of their waking hours, the prime of their lives, being dissatisfied. I mean, that's a very sort of powerful thing to think about. And healthcare is, you know, one of those issues that is very difficult to navigate. You know, there's a couple of things. I mean, there is a lot of, at least in Vermont, which of course is sort of a hotbed of so-called alternative healthcare. You know, I've almost in my life come to see sort of, you know, the mainstream medical community as being the alternative. But, you know, there are a lot of people around us who offer healthcare, you know, through non-traditional channels that are far more affordable. The other thing I would point out, and this is perhaps, you know, sort of small compensation for those who do feel that vulnerability right now, is that, you know, one of the reasons our healthcare system is so profoundly broken is because it is so intertwined with money. And so if we continue to sort of feed it in that way, it's going to continue to be a race to the bottom. It's not going to get better. And so I guess, you know, I get those concerns. I feel those concerns sometimes in my life. But sometimes I feel like for myself, I think, you know, the less healthy thing I could do would be to just sort of, you know, give in to that fear and to go get a job that's going to provide me all these benefits and spend, you know, the bulk of my waking hours doing something I don't really want to do. I mean, that to me also feels really unhealthy. So, you know, part of it, I guess, is sort of determining, you know, what do we mean by being sort of healthy individuals? What is important to us? And maybe for some people, they do need to do that. This is one of the fascinating things about money, is that it's universal. We all need it. And it's also incredibly personal because all of us have slightly different situations around money. Some of us have a lot. Some of us have none or not enough. And so we all bring something different to the discussion. And I think it's one of the reasons that this, you know, this book, the conversations that have been resonating out of this book have been, I think, really quite, for me anyways, quite moving and really incredibly interesting.
So money is universal to the extent that everybody needs a certain amount of, you know, possessions, goods, food, that sort of thing, things that at least can be traded for cash in this world. Mm-hmm. But in terms of our sort of cultural relationship, I mean, it does seem that the American one is different than what you would find in Europe or parts of Latin America, where things might take longer and there's a little bit less rushing around and a little bit less and I'm generalizing here, but a little bit less obsession with, you know, acquisition of material goods. To the extent that this is somewhat uniquely American, why, what got us here?
Oh, yes. I think it's a real combination of factors. I mean, we cannot deny or ignore, I guess, the role that America plays in the world. You know, I mean, we are the superpower of the world. And part of that sort of, you know, privilege, I guess, is that, you know, we have the world's reserve currency. So, you know, we have sort of more ability than any other nation in this world to sort of call the shots on a global basis. And, you know, I almost mean that literally, because, of course, we have the strongest military in the world also. I think that's part of it. You know, we have a lot. We have historically had a tremendous degree of sort of ingenuity in terms of sort of production. And, you know, when production line assembly really sort of came on strong in the early 1900s, I mean, we were talking about, you know, Henry Ford going from, I believe, over the course of about a year and a half, he managed to take it from the Model T production of a Model T from about 12 hours to about an hour and a half. So all of a sudden, you know, we had this incredible surplus of goods in our nation about 100 years ago. And that sort of brought with it the issue of, like, okay, well, how do we convince people to buy these things? There was a real surplus of stuff. There was too much stuff for the people. And there was, at that point, the advent of sort of emotion-based marketing, which really sort of played on people's insecurities, you know, essentially convincing them that they needed to buy things in order to fit into their society. And you can see that, how that permeates our media today.
My guest is author Ben Hewitt. His new book is called Saved: How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Ben Hewitt. His new book is called Saved: How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Ben, jump in here and correct me if I am wrong on this, but I have to imagine that when you have friends over for dinner, they, you know, don't roll up in a Maserati and tell you all about their new summer place in Southampton. I mean, how important is it that your circle, your social circle, sort of is with you on these issues?
Yeah, I think it's really, I mean, in some ways I think it's really important. And it is, you know, earlier I sort of talked about a little bit about, you know, some of the sort of privileges that we enjoy that I might talk about later in the program. So maybe this is the time to sort of address that. Mm-hmm. You know, my family and I live on about $30,000 a year for a family of four, which is, I think, it's a little bit less than half the median income in this country for a family of that size. And, you know, we enjoy a tremendous degree of freedom over how we spend our days. I mean, I do work, but I do exactly what I love. I'm able to choose a career. I've chosen a career that doesn't necessarily pay me that well, but that really, really, you know, allows me to sort of, you know, fill my life with a lot of wonderful things. And a lot of that has been enabled because either of decisions that we made early or in our lives that we didn't even, in some ways, even consciously know we were making. For instance, and some of it's just good luck. So, for instance, you know, we bought our land in 1997, and we were able to buy 40 acres of land for $30,000. And I don't know what the market's like down there, but up here, you know, you couldn't do the same thing for three times that today.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a blue-collar, working-class community, you know, where I was, you know, always on working construction jobs when I was young, and basically picking up, you know, skills that then enabled us to build our own house. So Penny and I, my wife and I, built our house out of pocket over a period of time. And so, you know, the point I'm trying to get at is that we, you know, not through monetary privilege, but through, you know, sort of socio-cultural privilege of being sort of immersed in this landscape where there's not those expectations, where there are still those skills, you know, sort of percolating through the culture. You know, we were able to build ourselves a nice house on 40 acres of land, and at the age of 41, I'm debt-free.
Hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that I'm really struck by is that, you know, we have in our society, as ever more of the goods and services that we rely on become part of, you know, become commoditized, become part of, you know, sort of the monetary realm. We have to buy them. You know, we are slowly sort of these skills are sort of eroding out of our communities, and so it's much more difficult for us to do for ourselves in a way that was once really common. Now, Vermont is a little bit of sort of a holdout in that regard, you know, and especially sort of rural Vermont where we live. So people still have those skills, and there are, you know, ironically, I have a friend who comes from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he lives in Vermont now, and he's always saying to me, you know, you have no idea what the expectations are like out there in the rest of this country. You know, and those social expectations that you're talking about around here, you know, if you're driving a 20-year-old car, no one looks at you twice. That's kind of normal,
yeah.
You know. So it's a huge advantage. I cannot deny that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Madeline in Dallas. Hey, Madeline.
Hi. I'm wondering, it seems there's a lot of people out there who seem like they're just going from paycheck to paycheck, working all of these tough jobs that really take it out of them, but they're providing services that are essential for us. I mean, and I'm talking about like the construction job that you mentioned earlier, but it's, I mean, can we really get by on that? How can we change those people's kinds of lives to allow them more time to enjoy themselves and take those stresses off as well?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And you know, in some ways, we have to start looking, when we start thinking about that, you know, we really have to start looking at how the mechanism of money and, you know, why is it that some people who do really essential and wonderful work and really, you know, work that is worth a lot. I mean, you know, Eric does, I have gotten emails since the book came out and people, you know, have read about Eric and they say, And I've gotten a few emails from people who say, you know, I actually know Eric, and he has made profound changes in my children's life, and I'm just so sort of thankful that you're bringing some awareness to that. And yet, you know, even if he chose to work full-time, which he doesn't, but if he chose to work full-time, he wouldn't be making more than $12,000 or you know, maybe $15,000 a year. And the same is true, you know, for so many either essential occupations or ones that just add tremendous value to our lives. You know, people who even our teachers. I mean, think about how, you know, how we reward our teachers in a financial way. We simply do not really pay them what, you know, in any kind of sort of relation to their value. And yet we pay people who exchange, you know, odd financial instruments and derivatives. I mean, they're paid, you know, millions upon millions of dollars. So I think, you know, to really start to unravel that, we do have to start looking really closely at, you know, what are the mechanisms of money. And this book isn't really about monetary policy because it's such, in part because it's like one of those subjects I'm kind of scared of myself, you know. It's like, if you want to get really lonely at a party, start talking about monetary policy, you know. And yet, I think it's really important. There's one thing I think it's really important for people to understand about money is that the vast majority of money is issued as debt. And so when you go to the bank to take out a mortgage to buy a house, you know, we have this idea that the bank is somehow lending us some of their money, but that's not how it works. That money actually does not exist until you have borrowed it.
To the extent that in our culture, Ben, we value people who can do for themselves, who don't, you know, ask anybody for help, to the extent that that's, it's not possible to keep living that way if you want to sort of move away from focusing on money as a primary goal in your life, what does it take to sort of unlatch from the idea that somehow it's shameful to ask for help?
You know, I hear a lot from people when I'm out. I get this question. You know, what can I do? You know, I guess I'm still sort of best known for my first book, which was sort of about this small community in Vermont that's trying to regionalize a food system called The Town That Food Saved. And so people sort of think of me as someone who, you know, has really tremendous insight into community building. I'm not exactly sure why, but, you know, that's the idea that's out there. And so I hear a lot from people, you know, what can I do to sort of, you know, strengthen community in my area? And one of the things I think that is really profoundly effective is to ask somebody for help.
Hmm.
And we have to get over that. I mean, you know, and the reason it's so effective is because I want you to think about the last time you offered help to somebody and what they probably said, which I'm guessing was, oh, no, I'm all set. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I also want you to think about the last time someone came to you and asked you for help and how that made you feel, which I'm guessing was pretty good.
Hmm.
And I know how it makes me feel when somebody asks me for help. And I think that on a very sort of innate human level, we have a need to be needed. You know, we want to rely on one another. I think it's an important part of what it means to be human. You know, and the tragic irony is, I think the more we rely on money, you know, the less we end up relying on others, other people. And it becomes, you know, people think of money as sort of providing this tremendous security, but it's a very conditional security. Because the security it offers is only there for you if you can afford it.
Hmm.
And the real security, you know, is the people around you who are there for you whether or not you can afford it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Gabriel in Dallas. Hi, Gabriel.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, nice to meet you. Hey, this is very nice. It's good that you have written that book. Congratulations. I'm in
Thank
search
you.
Of the same thing. And, well, basically I have one question. Where can we find a guy like Eric here in the Metroplex that can teach us his ways in the wilderness and also in the finances?
Both.
Maybe I can rent him out. I don't know. My sense is that Eric is pretty immersed in his community here in Vermont. But I hope you do find someone. You know, one thing that's been really amazing for me and sort of, and I guess sort of hopeful is the number of people who have sort of come out of the woodwork, both over the context of sort of working on this book, you know, as I become more familiar and friendly with Eric's community, but also since the book has come out, you know, I'm meeting a lot of people who, you know, are really sort of living a lot and living in this way and living a lot of these values. And again, it's not always about how much money they have or they make. It's much more about, you know, about their embrace of these other aspects of, you know, what it means to be human and be wealthy and be prosperous. So I think these people are out there. I think, you know, they don't tend to seek out a lot of attention. I mean, Eric is one of the sort of least self-aggrandizing people I've ever met in my life. And frankly, he had to think long and hard about whether or not he even wanted this book to be written because he wasn't sure that he wanted his name out there. He's just not interested in that attention. And I think that's sort of generally true, you know, again, I'm speaking sort of broadly here, but I think that's generally true of people who have chosen similar lifestyles.
He does have a life partner, a serious girlfriend, who said she, you know, did not want to live in his sort of shack with bucket toilet and bought a place. Were you surprised when he moved in with her?
I was a little surprised, and I'm not sure it wasn't so much that she wouldn't have. I mean, I think she has a very similar ethos to Eric, and I have to say that the house that she bought is decidedly funky and, mm-hmm. you know, by most people's standards, pretty small and simple, you know. And, you know, I was a little surprised and, you know, frankly, a little concerned because, you know, the whole sort of thesis of my book at that point was sort of built on the idea that Eric had chosen this really Spartan lifestyle, you know, and all of a sudden he's got flush toilets and light switches, like, whoa, you know, the guy's like climbing the ladder here. And partly that was also at about that point that I was beginning to realize this wasn't really about a rejection of anything. Mm-hmm. It was much more about, again, you know, about this embrace of these other aspects. And, you know, they live in this house very simply, and the house is, I think it's about 900 square feet or so, and it's Eric and his girlfriend and Eric's brother and his girlfriend. So, you know, on a square footage basis, they're not actually inhabiting all that much more space than Eric's little 8x12 cabin that he was building. But, yeah, you know, at first I was a little taken aback. But now having seen how they inhabit the space, you know, it's really clear to me what their intent is for it.
So many people after the financial crash, you know, were talking about taking a harder look at their relationships to money and recognizing what was important and what had true value. Do you worry as things rebound a bit that Americans' appetite for this will diminish?
No, I don't. And I say that because in part because I'm just sort of I'm seeing the interest in this book being sort of greater than I could possibly have anticipated, which is wonderful. And I'm seeing that the conversations that are coming out of it are, you know, there's just a level of engagement that I you know, really only sort of dared to dream to hope for. I look at the way, I think money is sort of where food was in this country about 10 or 15 years ago, when there was this sort of, you know, all of a sudden this sort of awareness that, you know, maybe we ought to care where our food comes from, and maybe we want to sort of better understand the ramifications of our practices around agriculture and food. And, you know, money in some ways is a lot like food. I mean, we don't eat it, but it's something that we all need, and we need it, and we engage with it, you know, every day, usually multiple times a day. And so I think there is this awareness that's sort of spreading that we should really better understand how it works and what the ramifications of our arrangements and expectations and assumptions around money really are.
And whether we're actually making choices or allowing it to make choices for us.
Exactly. And I also think, you know, coupled with this is this awareness that all of these ways in which we've sort of, you know, measured our wealth we're realizing are kind of abstract and not really that meaningful. And so in some ways, it's like the richer we've become in all of this stuff, you know, the poorer we've become in things that really, truly matter, which is our relationships to other people, our relationship to the natural world upon which, you know, we all are ultimately dependent on. You know, and money, one of the things that's fascinating to me is that I think money, and this is part of the duality of money. I mean, money can do really good things, but it also has the capacity to really create separation between ourselves and other people, between ourselves and the natural world. And we really need to have, I think, a tremendous amount of awareness and intent for how we use our money and recognize the power of it. It's an incredibly powerful force.
Ben Hewitt's new book is called Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. Ben, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Joe Bellotti helping out on phones. Lindsay Connect produced the show, and Christine McConnell does the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. You can always email us at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.